from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Timing is everything. That's an adage confirmed by best-selling author Daniel Pink in his new book, When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. One example, if you're heading in for surgery, he says, better make it in the morning. In his research, Pink found compelling reasons to undergo surgery while hospital staff are most alert and engaged. Coming up on Forum, we'll discuss the science of perfect timing with best-selling author Daniel Pink. That's next, after this. Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, they say that timing is everything, and author Daniel Pink dug into the science of scheduling and timing for his new book, When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He joins us in studio to talk about building ideal schedules, when to get married or switch careers, what we can do to lead more engaged lives, and a number of other things that he takes up in this book. And good to have you back with us on Forum, Daniel Pink.
Great to be here.
Well, let's begin with the fact that you think timing is a science and not an art, because many would just disagree with that thesis.
I used to disagree with that thesis until I looked at the research. What I found in making my own decisions in my own life was I was making timing decisions, things like when should I do certain kinds of work, when should I exercise, when should I start a project, when should I abandon a project, in a completely haphazard way. And sort of bugged me a little bit. And so I said, well, there's got to be a better way to make these decisions. I looked around for some resources. There weren't. And then I started looking at the research. And here's where it gets really interesting. You have, across multiple disciplines, literally dozens of disciplines, scholars in economics, anthropology, cognitive science, endocrinology, asking very similar questions. What are the effects of times of day on our behavior, on our mood, on our performance? How do beginnings affect us? How do endings affect us? How do midpoints affect us? How do groups synchronize in time? And they're all asking these very similar questions in rigorous ways in different disciplines. And if you go wide enough and deep enough into this research, you can begin to piece together the evidence-based ways to make better timing decisions. And I've changed my view on this. Timing is much more of a science, much less of an art than we realize.
Well, you certainly bring that to bear in the book, and there's much to talk about in what you just outlined for us. But I got to tell you, I know a lot of people who say, I trust my gut, my intuition. You know, that's what I think of more in terms of when I'm going to make the right move or when I'm going to take an opportunity and try to extend it or anything like that that involves choice and decision making. They'll say, it's in my gut.
Yeah. Well, here's the great thing about intuition. Sometimes it's right. Other times it's really, really wrong. And so for me, sometimes our intuition, Margaret Thatcher once said that intuition is reason in a hurry. And that's true sometimes. But in other cases, we're making systematic. So, for instance, we don't believe necessarily that we should arrange certain kinds of work at certain times of the day. I'm just going to intuitively do certain work at a certain time of day. That's actually a really bad idea. The evidence says that if you systematically move certain kinds of work to certain times of the day, you're going to perform better. You might have an intuition about what time of day you should make a doctor's appointment. Well, I'm not going to make my decisions after looking at this research on hospital visits or doctor appointments based on my intuition about what the right time is, because the data tell us what the right time is.
Well, or they tell us what the wrong time is.
And yeah.
Like surgery, you're not supposed to get surgery in the afternoon because there's a lot of data that shows that maybe there's not as much washing or not as much care in the afternoon as there is early on in the morning when people start in their medical profession.
Oh, well, the research on time of day and healthcare is alarming. It is an eye-opener. So if you look at something like anesthesia errors are 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m., all right? You look at hand washing in hospitals, massive deterioration in hand washing in the afternoons. You look at colonoscopies. I don't know if you want to look at a colonoscopy, but if you consider colonoscopies.
Don't want to. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. If you consider colonoscopies, doctors find half as many polyps in afternoon colonoscopies as they do in morning colonoscopies. Let's talk about doctors prescribing unnecessary antibiotics. Far more likely to do that in afternoon exams than in morning exams, leading to the rise of superbugs that will kill us all.
And what do you say? Afternoons are our Bermuda Triangles?
The afternoons are the Bermuda Triangle of our day. We don't realize that. I'll give you, you know, I brought with me, Michael, an entire bucket of startling and alarming factoids for you. So let me pull out another one. Traffic accidents. Once you control for cars on the road, the most common period for car accidents is between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. The second most likely time to have a car accident, again, controlling for cars on the road, is 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. So there is, and the whole point of all of this is that our mood and our performance change over the course of a day in fairly regular, fairly predictable cycles. And if we're just alert to that, we can make better decisions and mitigate some of the harm and maximize some of the good.
Well, and here's something else that's counterintuitive. The fact is, you read Daniel Pink's book and you learn that lunch is the most important meal of the day, not breakfast, which we've been told since we were knee-high or whatever.
Absolutely. We've been told there are a couple of things with the research on breakfast. I'm a devout breakfast eater, okay? So that's one. My intuition—
No, I was glad. I don't eat breakfast, usually.
And we're both sitting here as healthy men right now, so it shows you—
Touch wood for Micah. Whatever,
yeah. So what the research on breakfast shows is that most of the studies are what are called observational studies. So what it shows is that people who eat breakfast are healthy. The reason for that, it could be that healthy people eat breakfast. That's not necessarily causation. And even worse, a lot of the studies that showed breakfast as this essential meal were funded by cereal companies. And so is breakfast an essential meal? I think the research doesn't tell us. Eat breakfast if you want. Don't eat breakfast if you don't want. It turns out, though, there's some pretty compelling research on lunch, not as a form of nutrition, but as a break in the day. You have people who regularly take lunch breaks experience less fatigue later in the workday. There's some evidence showing regular lunch breakers experience less fatigue a year later. And lunch is part of this remarkable body of research on breaks. What it tells us is that we should be taking more breaks and we should be taking certain kinds of breaks.
All right, I think I'll have a break right now. No, we're talking to Daniel Pink, and his new book is When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. And he has a number of other books out there, To Sell as Human, which we discussed on Forum, and Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us, and A Whole New Mind, Why Right Brainers Will Rule the Future. You talk about all those things, but let's get back to the timing, particularly in the course of a day, mm-hmm. because you get into a lot of that, a pattern of a day. I mean, there's big data out there. There's an analysis of about 500 million tweets and some research by Nobel laureates that you write about.
Sure.
One has to wonder about what time the president is tweeting. We don't need to get into that, but there's a peak, there's a trough, and there's a rebound. I mean, that's essentially the day.
Right. And we see that. And what's interesting about that is that we see a regular pattern of the day, a peak, a trough, and a rebound. Most of us go through it in that order, peak, trough, rebound. Those of us who are night owls go through it in the reverse order.
Wait a minute. Back up a minute. We want to talk about night owls?
Well, we can.
All right. Follow the day pattern.
Yeah. So peak, trough, recovery. And what's interesting about this is that different scholars in different fields have found the same thing asking comparable questions but using different methodology. So the research on tweets that you mentioned, researchers at Cornell analyzed 500 million tweets, half a billion tweets. And they put it into a program that measures the emotional valence, emotional levels of words, and that it's a text analyzer. And what the pattern showed was people had rising mood in the morning, declining mood during the trough of the afternoon, and then recovering mood later in the day. Daniel Kahneman, the famous Nobelist, did some similar kinds of research. He used a different method. He had people actually record each hour what they were doing and how they felt about it. He saw the same pattern. Peak in the morning, trough in the afternoon, recovery later in the day. And over again in all kinds of fields, we see this pattern of our mood. And that pattern of our mood then has a big effect on our performance, particularly at work.
And productivity and creativity.
Absolutely.
And all the rest
right.
of it. When you said night owl, I just jumped because we've got these chronotypes that you write about with circadian rhythms. And you've got not only owls, but larks and third birds. Let's break this down.
Okay, so all of us have what are called, as you mentioned, what are called chronotypes. And that's basically just our propensity to, do we wake up early and go to sleep early, or do we wake up late and go to sleep late? And there are changes in our propensities as we age. But in general, the distribution looks like this. About 15% of us are very strong morning people, larks. About 20% of us are very strong evening people, owls, and the rest of us are in the middle, what I call third birds. We're intermediate. And so and in this pattern, what's important is that larks and third birds go through it, peak trough recovery. Owls tend to go the other direction, recovery trough peak. They get their peak later in the day, which is why the whole corporate world completely conspires against owls.
You've given these talks to corporations, right, on this in terms of
gaining greater productivity? The book's only been out for a few weeks, but sure, yeah. People are interested in it because companies are interested in it because they're making bad decisions. All right, I mean, so what we know from this research is this, that we should be doing certain kinds of work at certain kinds of the day. So during our peak, we should be doing analytic work that involves heads down, focus, all right, reading a complicated text, writing something important, analyzing data. During our peak, we're most vigilant. We're able to bat away distractions. That's when we should be doing that work. In the trough, we should be doing the stuff that doesn't require a lot of cognitive load. We should be doing our administrative work, answering our nonsense emails, filling out, you know, expense reports. And then during the recovery, it's a very interesting period. The recovery, we have higher mood than during the trough, but we also are less vigilant than during the peak. And so the combination of elevated mood and disinhibition makes this a very interesting, powerful time for creative kinds of work, brainstorming, iterative kinds of exercise. And so the problem that we mentioned the companies, the problem that companies have is that they think all times of day are created equal, that it doesn't matter when people are working. And it does. It matters significantly. People should be doing their analytic work during the peak, their administrative work during the trough, and their insight creative work during the recovery. And what the research is telling us is that 20% time of day effects explain about 20% of the variance in how people perform on these workplace tasks. And yet you look at companies have these teams of larks or analytic thinkers, and the boss schedules a 9:30. They should be doing their heads down focus work in the morning. The boss schedules a 9:30 meeting about travel voucher policies.
They also have these companies that try to keep them there all day. You know, I mean, they have
past the point when they're actually working,
or when they're most productive.
Right. And so you know, again, focusing on the companies here for a second, you know, as individuals and organizations, we're pretty intentional about what we do. People have to-do lists. We're pretty intentional about who we do it with, how we do it. But when it comes to when we do it, we think, it doesn't really matter. And it matters. It has a material effect on our creativity, our productivity, our health and well-being. It has a material effect on how students score on standardized tests. I mean, I'm not saying it matters more than who or what or how, but it matters just as much.
Well, as long as we're talking about school, there is a lot more movement away from recesses, for example, which is, you know, goes counter to what you said about the importance of breaks. There's a lot of amalgamating of recess with lunch, for example, and there's definitely a movement along those lines. Plus, as you point out, it may be a mistake for many of the schools to start at the hours that they're starting at, as opposed to just kind of following where this research leads us.
You're right, sadly right on both points. So on recess, what this research on breaks is telling us is that breaks are a restorative that improve performance. I'll give you one example. There's research out of Denmark showing that on standardized tests, kids who took the standardized tests in the afternoon score lower than kids who take the tests in the morning. The kids who take the tests in the afternoon score as if they had missed 2 weeks of school. Now, how do you get those test scores back up? You give those kids a 20 to 30 minute break before they take the afternoon test. Boom. They're back scoring as if they otherwise would, and so what we have now is this move to eliminate recess, eliminate breaks, this kind of hyper puritanical view that breaks are a concession, that they're a sign of weakness, when what we know about performance is that breaks are part of our performance. The good news is that there's some intriguing evidence from some low income schools in Texas that are actually adding recesses as an effort to boost test scores. Now, when it comes to school start times,
got the American Academy of Pediatrics behind you there, right?
Yeah, I mean, we should be behind the American Academy of Pediatrics on this one. I mean, so what we have in chronotypes is that when people hit about the age of 14, they have a massive mood toward becoming much more late, much more evening types. People are extremely owly. It's physiological between the ages of 14 and about the age of 24. They shift literally 2, sometimes 3 hours later. And so the American Academy of Pediatrics, and again, that's a very they issued a policy statement. That's a little sterile. Policy statement from an association. So think of it instead as this. Think about all the pediatricians of America linking arms and marching through the streets, and they're saying to school districts across America, do not start school for teenagers before 8:30 in the morning. It is contraindicated by everything we know. We know that early school start times for teenagers increases the dropout rate, reduces test scores, contributes to depression, obesity, a whole parade of horrors. And so the pediatricians have been pleading with school districts, do not do this. Start school after 8:30. The average school start time in America today for teenagers is 8 o'clock, 8:03 a.m.
California's been a little bit better, in fact, considerably better in some ways. But you go across the United States and you're right.
What's interesting is that the districts that have changed this have seen really good results, lower dropout rates, less depression, even fewer car accidents. The other interesting thing about this is that the people who've studied this, it's a very cost-effective solution, too. I mean, to start school 45 minutes later, to start at 9:15 versus starting it at 8:15 is the bang for the buck there is enormous. And yet, there's this view that, oh, what difference could it make? These kids are lazy. What difference could it make to start at 8:15 versus 9:15? The difference that it makes is starting at 9:15 versus, say, 8 o'clock or 7:45 is fewer dropouts, higher test scores, less obesity, less depression, fewer car accidents.
That's dramatic differences.
This one's not even a close call.
Well, there's another one, though. Yeah. When you talk about bang for the buck and dramatic and not even a close call, it was fascinating to read the difference in earning power graduating college a recession versus graduating college when the economy is up.
So this is something that's actually where the solution is much more complicated here. This is some amazing research from Lisa Kahn at Yale University. She's an economist. And what she found is that if you take two people, one graduates, you know, we'll take, you know, Maria graduates in a recession and Esther graduates in a boom economy. Go 20 years out into their careers, Esther's going to earn more than Maria, even if they're same college, same major, same GPA, same industry, that when you graduate from college, that shows up in your wages literally 20 years later.
It's timing you can't control, though.
No, that's exactly the point. Yeah. So and that says is like, okay, so in that case, we have to do something about that. It's like, I have a whole chapter in this book on beginnings. There's some beginnings that we can control. There are other beginnings we can't control. And for that, you need a broader collective solution to that problem.
If you just joined us, we're talking with author Daniel Pink. His new book is When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing, and we'll bring you, our listeners, into this shortly. He'll be appearing tomorrow at the JCC in San Francisco at 7 p.m., and let's talk about naps, because these are very important and much more important maybe than most people realize. We had the head of the Berkeley Sleep Center on, and we were talking about their importance.
Yeah.
But you get down to the nitty-gritty here. You say the ideal time, not only are naps better, but 10 to 20 minutes, that's for all ages?
Yeah. In general, I mean, there's going to be a little bit of variation from age to age. Like little kids, obviously, are going to need more than 10 to 20 minutes. It's very interesting research on naps. Naps are a huge benefit, but the duration of a nap surprised me. And that the ideal nap, as you say, Michael, is between 10 and 20 minutes. You go longer than that, you begin to accumulate what's called sleep inertia, which is that sort of groggy feeling that you get. And I've changed my view on this. Like, I used to...
Do we know how long Reagan napped? He was napping all the time.
I don't... I wonder. Maybe he had some sleep inertia or that he was trying to shake up. Maybe sleep inertia is the cause of the Iran-Contra scandal. Who knows? What we know, though, is that these short naps give us the bang for the buck without the sleep inertia. And so I've changed my view on this. And there's an ideal nap, though, which is kind of interesting. And it goes like, and I've done this. And again, it's an N of one. But there's some other good evidence for why this is efficacious. And it's this. So we tend to hit our low point in the afternoon about 7 hours after waking up. Okay, so I woke up today at 7 a.m., so I'm going to hit my low point, say, at 2 p.m. All right. So I, is that right? Yeah, 2 p.m. All right. So you find your afternoon low point. All right. And I have these headphones, and I'll sit in a chair with headphones, and a quiet chair, a quiet place, headphones on. But then I do something peculiar. I have a cup of coffee. Now, stick with me. I have a cup of coffee. All right. Then I set my phone alarm for 25 minutes. It usually takes me maybe 10 or 11 minutes to fall asleep. And so I end up with a nap, and then my phone goes off at 25 minutes. So I end up with a nap of, say, 14 minutes. That's right within that 10-minute to 20-minute window, right? So I wake up. I don't have the sleep inertia. But wait, that coffee, it takes about 25 minutes for coffee, for caffeine to get into our bloodstream. And so at the moment I'm waking up without that sleep inertia, boom, I get the second kick of caffeine. It is a technique known as a nappuccino. Nappuccino is the ideal nap.
Talking again with Daniel Pink, educating us about nappuccinos and timing and many other things here. You write about beginnings and middles and ends, like you said at the top of the program, and early beginnings are best. I think the research shows that and so forth. But then you get a lot of things kind of lumped together here. By that, I mean you can talk about, for example, beginnings in terms of the beginning of the week. Mondays are usually better. I don't know. Mondays, I get all, involved with what I have thinking weighing on my shoulders for the rest of the week. I start unwinding as the week gets toward the end of the week. Of course, I only work a four-day week on radio, but the reality is very different for me. I'm just wondering about what the research shows, because when you say, for example, a first day on a job or a birthday or, just beginnings are good generally. A Monday, for some people, is not necessarily all that. It's Blue Monday. It's Domino saying about
that. No, I think that's a fair point. What we're talking about is not necessarily Mondays in this case, but we're talking about what researchers call temporal landmarks. And there's some great research from Katie Milkman, Heng Chen Dai, and Jason Reese at Penn, University of Pennsylvania. And what they have found is that certain dates in the year stand out as landmarks in the way that physical landmarks stand out. And these temporal landmarks stand out. They do a couple of things. One, they get us to slow down. Two, they trigger this peculiar form of mental accounting where we open up a fresh ledger on ourselves. So, for instance, people are more likely to start and more likely to be successful in starting a diet if they do it on a Monday rather than a Thursday. If they do it on the first of the month rather than the 13th of the month. If they do it on the day after their birthday than the day before their birthday. This is what they call the fresh start effect. Blue Monday could be a sign that you have a job you hate. It has nothing to do with timing.
True. Well, we are talking about timing. That's the real focus for this hour with Daniel Pink. And let me invite you, our listeners, to join us with any questions or comments you might have. A lot of advice in this book. By the way, if somebody says to you, I have good news and bad news, what do you want first? Say bad news. That's what the research shows. Get the bad news out of the way, and then you'll feel more elevated. You can join us toll-free, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Welcome your questions or comments. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways to join the program, and we invite you to do that now. Daniel Pink will be appearing tomorrow at the JCC in San Francisco at 7 p.m., and in the meantime, any questions or comments for him about timing, feel free to join us. I'm Michael Krasny. It's the great Jimmy Jones. Well, this is my proclivity for rock trivia. I dug that out of my consciousness and thought it would be a good song to bring in out of the break. You have to decide again on timing. Should it be before the break or after the break? You want to say something about, we're coming up on Valentine's Day, timing and romance? That's what he's singing about.
Yeah.
What are any research on
there's that? There's some interesting research on timing of marriages. This is from Nicholas Wolfinger at the University of Utah, who showed that I think this is one where you need a couple of grains of salt, where he found that there is a sweet spot in terms of when you get married and how long your marriage will last. between the ages of about 25 and 32 seems to be the sweet spot. So believe it or not, 24-year-olds have an 11% greater chance of getting divorced. If you get married at 24, you have an 11% greater chance of getting divorced than at 25.
When was this research done?
This is done in the last, I think he looked at maybe data from over the last 30, 40 years or something like that. So it's, again, it doesn't mean if you get married at 24, you're going to get divorced. You get married at 33, you're going to get divorced. You get married at 30, you're going to be okay. I think that actually the more interesting research comes out on marriage comes out of Emory, which shows that the more you spend on your wedding and your engagement ring, the less likely the marriage is to succeed.
That's a sobering.
It's a good. I think it's a. I think
well, it's a good warning.
I think
caveat.
It's a prudent Valentine's Day message.
Yeah,
Michael.
Very important. Let's just talk briefly. We'll go to our callers here in a moment. But there's this Dabbawalas that you write about in Mumbai, and they're completely in sync. They're in sync with the purpose that they have, which is essentially waiting on people and to their boss and to their tribe and all that. But it's group timing. And group timing is one of the more fascinating elements of this, because you talk about some research in the National Basketball Association where people, for example, who give more high fives and do that sort of fist sort of thing and have more success.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting piece of research on – there's so much interesting research on how groups coordinate. So I went to Mumbai, India to study these people who are known as Dabbawalas. It's a fascinating phenomenon where in India you have people who work in offices who actually don't want to go to Chipotle or something for lunch, instead want a home-cooked meal. But they're leaving for the office at 7 o'clock in the morning. So sometimes – and a lot of middle-class people have cooks. Sometimes women are staying home. And so these people at home make a home-cooked meal and then but have to get that home-cooked meal in these metal tiffins to the desk in downtown Mumbai. And they rely on these squadron of guys called Dabbawalas who go pick up the lunches at people's apartments and then take them to the offices, often 15 miles away. They do this with no technology, no scanners, no GPS. They rely on the train system. They rely on buses. They rely on this complex coding system that they mark up the lunches. And they deliver 200,000 lunches every day without error. UPS and FedEx have gone out to study these guys. Harvard Business School has a case study about them because they're so beautifully synchronized. And one way that the reason for that is that they have a sense of belonging with each other. And belonging is fostered by a number of different things. But on the NBA research, what it showed is that if you look at just a video early in the season of teams, not knowing anything about the teams, put people, say, just watch these videos and count how many times they do fist bumps, chest bumps, low fives, high fives, that touching behavior ends up being predictive of who's going to succeed and who doesn't. I was actually watching the Warriors Suns game last night, looking for that, and I noticed just an enormous amount of just high fives, just sort of almost unconscious touching, which actually fosters a sense of belonging.
Also, lest we forget, as long as we're on this subject, there's a lot of data about teams that are behind at like midtime.
At halftime, oh yeah,
at halftime, midbreak, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. I mean, in different sports, and if they're behind by a little bit, in many cases, it means they're going to win.
This is remarkable research. This is from Jonah Berger and Devin Pope. Berger's at Penn. Pope is at University of Chicago. They looked at this something like 20,000 NBA games, and they looked at the halftime score. Now, here's the thing. A team that's ahead at halftime is more likely to win the game. Okay, that's mathematically not that complex. All right, they have more points already, and the game's half over. But there was an exception to that. Teams that were down by 1 point were more likely to win than teams that were up by 1 point. Being down by one was equivalent to being up by two. And there's other research showing that when we hit a midpoint and we feel like we're slightly behind, we just bring it in that second half, that there's something very motivating about being slightly behind at the middle. If we're way behind, we give up. If we're way ahead, we grow complacent. But being slightly behind at the midpoint is invigorating.
You know, one of the most astonishing things about your book is the amount of research that's being done in this whole area of
research. This is why we don't have to rely on intuition, Michael.
Let me bring some callers in here. Let me begin, let me get a caller on. Robin, you're on. Hi.
Yes. Hi, good morning. I have a question, but what you were just saying about the Dabbawalas brought to mind an absolutely charming movie. I wonder if you've seen it, and if you haven't, I recommend it. It's called The Lunchbox, and I believe it's an Indian film, and it's about this very subject. And
I saw it. It is a charming film.
I saw it, too. I recommend that movie almost as strongly as I recommend my own book.
It's so sweet. It's so sweet about the crossed wires and the mix-up with the lunches.
And it's built on something that rarely happens, which is that in that case, in the movie, the catalytic event is that the Dabbawala made a mistake, which they apparently never do.
They almost never do, right?
I thought it was adorable. Anyhow, my question is, I have heard or read, I don't remember, that if you want to ask something of someone, such as perhaps a raise or a favor, that you should wait till after lunch to do so, for probably at least the afternoon. What's your thoughts on that?
There's actually some good research on this, believe it or not. What it shows is this. So let's take human decision making in general. What it shows is that when people make decisions, decision makers often come in with a default decision, and the default decision is usually no. So in the case of, say, a raise, your boss's default decision is going to be no, you can't have a raise. Or you're trying to sell somebody something, they're going to say no, I don't want to buy that. And so what the research tells us is that decision makers are more likely to challenge the default decision early in the day and immediately after a break. So early in the day is better, but if you go immediately after a break, your odds are slightly higher. And this is built on some pretty alarming research out of Israel about judges making decisions on parole. What they found is that if you have your parole hearing early in the day, you have over a 50% chance of being granted parole. As the day proceeds, your chances deteriorate significantly. However, if you're the person or people immediately after the judge having her break, your odds go back up to something like 80%. So when we think about this, you have to think about what state are decision makers in, when are they willing to challenge their default, and in general, they're willing to challenge the default early in the day and immediately after a break.
Let me thank you, Robin, for the call. And again, if you'd like to join us, it's 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org. Let's go to Aaron in San Bruno. Aaron, you're on.
Hi, good morning. My question and comment regards if there have been any long-term studies for early start time for high school students. I graduated high school 20 years ago, and I had 3 years of an early 7 o'clock choir before class. And I definitely experienced many of those symptoms, both one car accident and obesity and stress and all of that. And I'm dealing with this 20 years and changing my habits. And so just wondering about, have there been any long-term studies and what the research shows?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know of any that have traced a single population from high school all the way through. But what we do know is we do know things like dropout rates. And so dropping out of high school is, you know, not surprisingly, the evidence on dropping out of high school, it's a terrible thing to happen to a kid. And it leads to terrible life consequences. And so it wouldn't surprise me whether there are these long-term effects that come from that. And it's, you know, and it's one of the, it's to me, it's one of the alarming things about this particular research on school start times, which is that the evidence is so overwhelming that starting school early for teenagers is a wretchedly bad idea, and yet over and over again we persist. And I remember, you know, I went to high school even longer ago, and I just remember when I took French in high school and with Mademoiselle Inglis, and I had French first thing in the morning, and she would go around the class and say, you know, to everybody, comment allez-vous, how are you? And everybody would say, je suis fatigué, everybody was tired, je suis fatigué, everybody was tired. So this has been going on, you know, for decades, and the lack of progress is actually alarming.
Let me thank Aaron for that call. You know, she was talking about singing in a chorus, and you read your book and realize that if you sing in a chorus or a group, it's as good as physical exercise.
Okay, this is amazing, all right? The research on choral singing is mind-blowing to me. I was just so taken aback by this. Okay, psychologically, singing in a group, not just singing in a group boosts people's mood incredibly. It can be a prophylactic against depression, right? What it can also do is it changes us physiologically. So people who sing in choirs, if we were to sing in a choir together, let's say you and I are in a choir, and you measure our threshold of pain before singing in a choir and after singing in a choir, our pain threshold is going to be higher. Also, if you something even more dramatic, take somebody, draw their blood before singing in a chorus for an hour, measure their immunoglobulin levels. Have them sing in a chorus, measure their immunoglobulin levels again. Their immune response has gone up. I was astonished by this research. Choral singing is...
It's the communal feeling, not necessarily the singing, though.
It's true. No, the communal, right, because singing alone doesn't have these effects. But you see it less robustly, but still very strongly in things like dancing, group dance, social dancing. You see it even in rowing, which I write a little bit about, group rowing, where the pain threshold of someone doing the exact same thing, rowing individually and versus rowing in a team, doing the exact same physical exertion, the person rowing in a team will experience less pain. There's something about human beings where we are wired to coordinate with each other. And then there's a great effect on children. Children who do coordinated synchronous activities end up subsequently much more open to playing with kids who aren't like them, much more likely to collaborate, much more likely to cooperate. There's something intrinsic about working in time, coordinated in time with human beings, with other human beings.
There's some studies like of the synchronized swimmers and all that.
There's a lot of, and it's in a number of different, it's in even putting kids on swing sets, having kids swing on swing sets synchronously, you know, together versus asynchronously, out of sync. They actually will be slight differences in behavior afterwards. Syncing with other people is a profoundly human experience. I don't fully understand it, but I'm mesmerized by it.
We're not talking S-I-N-K-I-N-G here.
No.
You can sync with other people all the time. Let me get another caller on.
That could be
on
what we're doing now.
We're not syncing. We're elevating.
Oh, that's right.
This is good conversation. Sarah, could you join us, please? You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. I'm calling. I wanted to know about the nap thing. If somebody sleeps 5 or 5.5 hours a night, are you still recommending a nap time of that duration, 10 to 15 to 20 minutes?
Well, I mean, I'm not a sleep scientist, and I don't know all that research.
Excuse me, Danny, we did have a sleep scientist on. He said you should be sleeping 7 or 8 hours.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to preface my medical advice with the fact that I'm not a medical professional, which is that in general, five to five and a half hours is too little sleep for almost everybody. There are a few people in the distribution of how much sleep you need. There are a few outliers, not that many, who can get by on that. But most people need at least a couple more hours of sleep.
So we have a public health crisis now. We talked about that and the fact that people are kind of competitive about how little they can sleep.
It's a terrible mistake. So I don't think that napping is a Band-Aid over an injury that needs a different response. If you're only sleeping 5 hours a night,
sleep more, Sarah. That's the advice.
Yeah, if you can. Now, if you have some kind of sleep disorder or something like that, it's another story. But I mean, the better solution is to reconfigure your day and get, you know, 6.5 hours or 7 hours.
And good luck to you, Sarah. Thank you for joining us. I'm sleeping more as I get older. I think
people do.
And our
chronobiology changes over time too. So you know, our teenagers are very owly, but as we age, we get much more larky. The chronotypes of little kids and people say 75 and older are very similar.
Larky. There's a word. Let me give you some comments that are coming in here. Pete writes, how do you identify troughs and know when to put creative work aside? How much less likely is it to have an aha moment during an off-peak period?
Great question from Pete. We end up having aha moments more likely in our non-peak time. And the reason for that is that during our peak, as I was explaining earlier, we're locked down, we're vigilant, we're batting away all kinds of distractions, keeping out all kinds of intruders. During our recovery period, we're just a little looser, and that ends up being very helpful for certain kinds of creative work, letting in a few of those distractions. This is what these researchers who've done this work call the inspiration paradox, that people do better at that kind of truly, the term that they use in these papers is a flash of illuminance. You're more likely to get a flash of illuminance in your non-peak time than in your peak time. This is why that recovery period, elevated mood, lower inhibitions, is where we should be doing our creative work, our brainstorming.
Well, then you talk about endings and you say, we got a kind of 3E here for the endings: energize, encode, edit, actually 4, and elevate.
Yeah. Oh, endings are amazing. I mean, the fact that endings have on our behavior. So, for instance, if you think about something like first-time marathoners, the age at which people are most likely to run their first marathon is age 29. It's a peculiar number, right? But you unpack it, 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 28-year-olds. 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 30-year-olds. Then you see disproportionate marathoning, first-time marathoning at 39, at 49. 49-year-olds, three times more likely to run a first marathon than 50-year-olds. And so when we hit the end of something, when the end of something becomes salient, we end up, this is our first E, you end up energizing. You kick a little bit harder. And so endings can have a very energizing effect on our behavior.
Well, you said earlier that the middle of our day is our Bermuda Triangle of the day. But here's Jack who writes, I've always been taught that people are sharpest and easier to do business with right after lunch as opposed to later in the afternoon. True?
It depends. I mean, if lunch is a break, then if you think about lunch as a break, there's going to be a moment after a break when people making decisions are going to be more likely to challenge the default, when they're going to be a little bit more restored. But in general, that period of the mid-afternoon trough is not—it's truly not good for very much. We should be shoveling our administrative work into that area. But to the point, I think one of the most important takeaways from all this research is— we need to be much more observant about our own behavior. We tend to be reasonably good at observing other people's behavior, but we don't look at our own behavior enough. And so we should be thinking at different points
of the
day.
That's true with everything in addition to timing.
I mean, yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, we should be thinking, oh, how do I feel right now? What is it like to do this work in the morning? What is it like to do that work in the afternoon? When do I experience this lull? And if we're more observant about our own behavior, we're going to see that we're not the same throughout the day. And if we're conscious of that, we can actually, you know, rearrange our schedule just a tad and get a little bit more work done and maybe feel a little bit better.
Daniel Pink is with us. His new book is called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. And let me get some more calls here. We've been getting a lot of questions about Olympic athletes. Before I go to a call, a listener says, this morning's New York Times had an article about how athletes at the Olympics are having a hard time performing in the early morning. Can you speak to the relationship between performance and circadian rhythm?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's some really interesting research on that. A lot of it, again, not all of it, some of it has to do with body temperature. Our body temperature, again, something that when I started this research, I was like, body temperature, who cares? Like, but there are predictable changes in our body temperature. And one of the things,
and they're linked to circadian rhythms.
Yeah. I mean, it's part of our circadian rhythms. Yeah. And so body temperature changes in a predictable way. And our body temperature is highest at, in the late afternoon and early evening. In fact, there's some very intriguing evidence that world records in speed events happen disproportionately between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. local time. You also see when people exercise later in the day, if you take people who exercise later in the day and people who exercise earlier in the day, there are more injuries when people exercise earlier in the day than they are than later in the day, because they're literally later in the day more warmed up. And so what it could be is that time of day is that people's body temperatures aren't where they usually are for performance, and it could be dampening their performance.
But just as you have this ornithology about, you know, larks and owls and third birds, aren't there? There are people who are diurnal and people who are nocturnal by nature.
Sure, absolutely. So it could they absolutely. The other thing could be that some of these athletes have evening chronotypes. They're late people and they're not obviously athletics is not only about physical performance at that level. It's heavily mental. And so if you're performing at a time that isn't your intellectual peak, that could also be compromising your performance.
And let me get another caller on. Brad, that's you. Thanks for waiting, Brad. You're on.
Oh, I just, first of all, I'm supposed to be working, but I'm taking a break. And a friend of mine years ago, he was an engineer, and he was his company sent him to Tokyo. And his very first day on the job, he went to the restroom, and when he came back out in the office, everyone was gone. And he thought there was an emergency, and he ran to the window and looked out in the parking lot, and everyone was stretching.
Mm.
And they all came back inside, and everyone went back to work, and he asked one of his coworkers, can I do that? And they said, you're supposed to. And he did it, and he said it was grand. It was like adult recess. And so when he came back to the United States, and this isn't a recent thing. This was years ago. He was working for a large company, Corning. I think I'm allowed to say the name. And he said to his supervisors, I think we ought to do this. And they thought he was nuts. But he always thought that adult recess was a really good idea for work production.
Well, heck, Brad, you know, you go to a baseball game, you take a seventh inning stretch,
sure.
Right?
Sure.
What's wrong with stretching?
No, it's generally good. I mean, actually, that practice is very consistent with what we know about the science of breaks. We know that in general, for breaks, the most restorative breaks, we know that something is better than nothing. So doing something is, rather than just continuing to sit, is better. We know that moving is better than stationary. So this ticks the moving box. We know that outside is better than inside. And we know that social is better than solo. And so a social break outside doing something physical is in many ways the platonic ideal of a break. I actually this notion, I wish I had used that phrase adult recess, because in a sense that's sort of what we're talking about. But more important, what we're talking about is looking at breaks differently. Not looking at breaks as a concession, as a deviation from performance, but as part of performance itself. And we know these athletes here in in South Korea right now, they are good break takers. Elite athletes know how to take breaks. Breaks are part of their performance.
It's the first time I've heard platonic linked to breaks, I must confess. Let me thank...
Well, Plato took breaks.
Yeah, he did. Brad, thank you for the call. And here's Debbie, who writes, as a healthcare worker, we have to deal with 24-hour-a-day shifts. I'm especially interested in what happens during 12-hour shifts, which have become increasingly common.
Yeah, no, that's a big issue. And so we can't simply – you can't just say – you know, if you think about an emergency room can't just say, oh, we're on adult recess right now. We can't deal with this wounded body. One of the remedies that's coming up, especially in healthcare, is breaks. And so this research showing this deterioration of hand washing in the afternoon, the remedy for that was mostly nurses giving more breaks, in particular social breaks. The other thing that's happening in medical settings is also in surgeries and things are, and I write about this a little bit, are timeouts, where before beginning a procedure, literally everybody takes a step back and goes over the procedure one more time before doing it, to make sure that we know what we're doing, we know how to do it, we have all the equipment. And
this is also used with kids when they're needing discipline, take a time out, right?
Yeah, a lot of the breaks are
No, it's supposed to make them reflective, and that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, right. No, a lot of these breaks are sort of restorative of our physical and emotional energy or intellectual energy. These kinds of breaks in healthcare settings end up being very much about vigilant. We're going to take a break to make sure we're doing this right. We're going to have a checklist. Both those vigilance breaks and restorative breaks, especially, I mean, a 12-hour shift in a healthcare setting is grueling. And if you don't build in breaks and if you don't build in mechanisms to prevent some of the slip-ups that we have, it's a big mistake.
Here's a question a little bit from left field, but I like it. Does Daniel have any insight into comedic timing?
Apparently not. You know what's interesting is that I don't, but...
Now, that is almost intuitive.
I think that comedic timing is almost musical in that way, in that you have to know...
Yeah, it's like jazz.
Yeah, exactly. You have to know when to come in. You have to know when to hold back, and how loud to play the note, how soft to play the note. But that's just a long-winded way of saying I don't know.
Well, here's another caller. Alan, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, my name's Alan. I had a question. I work with a lot of female coworkers, and I'm wondering, in regards to team aspect, is there something besides touching that can foster a social building?
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. In terms of belonging, there are a number of things that can foster a sense of belonging in teams. Very, very interesting research here. So one of them is certain kinds of inside jokes, inside lingo, jargon, and things like that. A shared language ends up being pretty important. The other thing is rituals, certain kinds of self-organized rituals. So in a company environment, what you see is when the company demands that everybody go out and play softball or do some kind of forced activity, those don't work very well in fostering a sense of belonging. What does work very well, and you see this organically inside of companies, is when they start a tradition where every Friday somebody brings in a pie, or every Thursday they go out to lunch at a certain place and order a certain thing. These self-organized rituals, certain kinds of lingo, certain kinds of shared experiences that are self-organized and autonomous are very powerful bonding agents.
Well, apropos of that, I have to read this comment from Mark. He says, when facilitating meetings to engender collaboration, I've noticed participants who have a strong history of enmity and argument are more willing to collaborate after I serve starchy food.
Could be. Yeah. Could be. Maybe you just dulled their senses.
Well, I don't want us to make of that, but it's fascinating. Quick note, Ron asks, coming up, the time, our timing is crucial here, but he wants to know about seasons and how they play into timing.
Yeah, there's some research on that. Actually, the season in which you're born plays an outsized role in your chronotype, believe it or not. And the reason for that is it could be that basically exposure to sun even while you're in a room, in a womb.
April is the cruelest month.
So there are some effects, but I mean the most important thing is really to be intentional about our when decisions, think about timing as a material fact of our lives, and recognize we're temporal creatures living in a temporal environment.
You mean we're not eternal? Okay, we'll end on that note. It's been fun having you on. Thank you, Daniel, and it certainly has been enlightening. And this is Timing, the song again by Jimmy Jones. Scientific Secrets of Timing is the subtitle of the book. The book is called When, and you can meet Daniel Pink tomorrow at the JCC in San Francisco at 7 p.m.